Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, helping to make Easter dinner easy with ready-to-heat and serve citrus-glazed ham, au gratin potatoes, deviled eggs, and pastry trays. Make it easy with Harmon's.
Stefan Fatsis is the kind of journalist who likes to live the experience of the subject he's investigating. It was a technique the writer George Plimpton used when he trained as a quarterback for the Detroit Lions and pitched on the mound in Major League Baseball. Fatsis trained as a place kicker with the Denver Broncos for his book A Few Seconds of Panic. For his book Word Freak, he entered tournaments to play competitive Scrabble. And in his latest project, he embedded himself in the exciting world of, wait for it, dictionaries. Fatsis loves dictionaries, and he knows exactly when he fell in love. It was his 11th birthday when he got, as his present, the Webster's New World Dictionary of the American Language.
I'm holding it right now. I got a dictionary on my 11th birthday from my mother. It is a Webster's New World Dictionary, second college edition, deluxe color edition. It's got this lovely robin's egg blue hardcover. I lost the jacket years ago. It is bandaged, covered with clear tape, which I had to do multiple times. I used this book when I was a kid in high school, when I was an editor and a reporter at my college newspaper, and into my career for many, many years. I carried this book around with me until whatever newspaper or wire service I was working for used a different source, and I had to switch it out on my desk. So it's deeply meaningful to me. So I owe a lot to my mom. She must have been pretty prescient to buy this book and inscribe it to Stefan. A very happy birthday. Love and kisses, mother and daddy. It started me on this lifelong love of words that kind of transformed my career and my life and my interests. I love that dictionaries represent opportunity, the opportunity to get lost in language, to learn something you didn't know, and then while you are rummaging for one particular piece of information, stumbling on to another piece of information. I love that they represent a kind of authority, trust in knowledge, that we believe the dictionary and should, because of the hard work that goes into the dictionary, that the dictionary matters and it was created by people who understand language and its history and its roots and who have spent time trying to parse what these symbols that we use, these letters that we string together in the form of words, what they mean. Dictionaries are sort of a guide to life, designed and created to be obvious, intended to be anonymous. That's one of the remarkable things about it, and an emblem of its success for generations. You open up a dictionary, whether you are typing into a search bar or turning the pages of a physical book, and you don't really think, oh, somebody created this. It's by design supposed to leave you comfortable with what's inside. You don't question what's in the dictionary because you appreciate that it's come to be regarded as trustworthy. And we don't have a lot of things that are trustworthy in culture anymore. And this, to me, remains a sort of bastion of trust. And I think that's important.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Stefan Fatsis is with us. His new book is called Unabridged. It's about how a dictionary gets made, like what counts as a word, the process of it, which can be incredibly painstaking because culture and technology is always changing the language. The book, though, is also a history of the dictionary, and in particular, the life of the ambitious, restless, eccentric Noah Webster, who published the first comprehensive American dictionary in the early 1800s, and he devoted his life to shaping American English. We began our conversation with Fatsis's idea of embedding himself with Merriam-Webster as they're preparing for their newest edition.
I knew that Merriam was undertaking this project to overhaul the 1961 unabridged dictionary. 500,000 words hadn't been updated in half a century, was one of the sort of cultural pillars of the 1960s. That this book was pilloried in the press, went viral. It was viewed as permissive, the downfall of culture. The New York Times editorialized about it multiple times. There were multi-thousand word screeds written about how bad this book was. And all of that was misunderstood. It was really misguided. This dictionary was different. It was descriptive. Its goal was to reflect society back to the reader, to tell people how they used words and have that be the source of information. It wasn't prescriptive, which was the guiding principle for dictionaries for generations before. So I was taken with the idea of revising this mammoth work. I mean, 500,000 words is a lot of words. Merriam projected that this was going to take decades, like 20 years, 30 years to complete. So I was intrigued by how in the digital age you go about revising this masterwork. What do you focus on? How has style changed? What are the most important elements of dictionary definitions for a modern consuming public? So I persuaded Merriam to let me do a magazine story. And I just did the reporting thing. I went up there for a few days and I hung out and I did lots of interviews and I wrote a 10,000 word piece for Slate. And when I was done, I wanted to do more. And I approached the publisher, John Morse, Merriam-Webster, and said, I'd like to do a book. And he said, I knew you'd want to do a book. And I then said, but if I do a book, I want to embed. I want to become a lexicographer. I want to understand how people do this.
In your sort of George Plimpton-like way, you embed there in Springfield, Massachusetts. But what did you think that meant, embedding? Because you weren't just a journalist observing. It seems like you just really wanted to be a part of it, not for the fun of it. Although I think that's probably true, but
yeah.
Like, what did you? There was some deeply personal interest for you here in this project, I guess.
Absolutely. I mean, I had done two previous books in which I embed Plimpton-like in different subcultures. One was about the world of Scrabble, which is very directly connected to my interest in doing the dictionary book. And the other one was specifically Plimpton-like. I became a kicker for the Denver Broncos in training camp and wrote a book about life in the NFL. And those may seem like oddly disparate subjects, and on their face they are. But my goal in doing the thing that I want to write about is to demonstrate to the subjects, the people I'm writing about, that I care. And I have found that, like, doing those things and trying to become expert at them, or at least learning what it takes to become expert at them, allows me to A, write more authoritatively about the subjects, but B, introduce myself as a character and hopefully get the reader on my side. Is he going to become a Scrabble expert? Is he going to make a field goal in training camp? Is he going to get some words into the dictionary that he defines? And they all seem weirdly different, but to me, they are all sort of part of the same narrative journalistic process. And And I found that to be true with this book as well. You know, a little bit different. I mean, there was the you know, I'm not putting on a helmet and like trying to kick a 40-yard field goal. I'm entering into this monastic, traditional American business lexicography in this library, quiet editorial room in this 80-year-old building in Springfield, Massachusetts. So the challenge journalistically was a little bit different, to say the least. But ultimately, it's the same sort of personal quest to illuminate something about a culture that a lot of people don't know, that most people don't know about.
And we should say you kicked the field goal, which we'll get to in a minute. I mean, you defined something like 90 words, managed to get 14 of them, I think it was, into the dictionary. Mm-hmm. We'll get to that in a second. Right. But let's back up for a minute and just talk about you wanted to be a lexicographer in training. But what is a lexicographer? I mean, you describe it in the book as a craft. But just for those who don't know, what is it?
A lexicographer is the person that writes the definitions for dictionaries. And it's a job that hasn't changed that much since Samuel Johnson was crafting definitions in the 18th century and Noah Webster was creating his landmark 1828 American dictionary that shaped the dictionary business in the United States after the Revolutionary War. The people that write these definitions are trained, usually as linguists, often with advanced degrees, but the job itself is very much a research job. You are trying to gather as much information through what are known as citations, examples of usage of words in media, written these days, social media qualifies, and it can be books, newspapers, magazines. It could be the back of a Kleenex box. It can be a government contract. It can be anything, anywhere that editors find interesting uses of individual words. Those are gathered by Merriam-Webster, and they've been collected for more than a century, for the last 20 or so years digitally, for the 100 years before that, on little slips of paper called citation slips that were stuffed into these incredible filing cabinets on Merriam's editorial floor. There are more than 16 million pieces of paper in these cabinets. It's kind of a remarkable thing. And the lexicographer's job is then to take all of the information that they gather and sift through it and try to make sense of a word, try to distill the essence of its word as it's used by human beings in what used to be professionally edited publications, but again, now social media also fits, and then produce a short, concise, understandable definition with other information to go along with it.
So if you got 14 of these suckers into the dictionary. So if you took one of those, like microaggression or headbutt, like maybe just sort of pick one of those words and just give us a sense of how you shepherded it through the process. Like how does it – and how long does this take? And so what are you looking for? Like where do you even start?
So Merriam-Webster had a spreadsheet called New Words in which editors would add candidate words. And that wouldn't mean that an editor would necessarily define that particular word. It's just sort of an early warning system. Like you saw a word that wasn't in Merriam's online dictionary and you added it to the spreadsheet and you included some basic information, what it probably means, a little snap definition, a little backing information because you've done a quick search on Nexus or newspapers.com or Google. And then it just sits there until it's time for an editor to decide, okay, that word looks like we should add it. an editor will also include a sort of an urgency scale number from like 1 to 5. Hmm. How urgent is adding this word to the lexicon? And microaggression was already in the spreadsheet, but I had seen it and knew it was out there. And I was looking for words that weren't in Merriam's online dictionary. And that was one of them. I was looking for words that were culturally relevant and important. And I asked the editor who actually did include it in the spreadsheet, hey, would it be okay if I tried to define this word? And she said, great, go for it. The first thing I did was go to those filing cabinets. Those are called the consolidated files, the ones with the 16 million slips of paper, to see if microaggression was in there. And lo and behold, it was. And the first card was from 1974, I believe.
Wow.
73 or 74. Yeah. And the one thing you learn in defining words is that, and in studying language, is that everything you think is new is not.
Is not, yeah.
Every debate that happens over some grammatical argument or pet peeve has been had for a very long time. And microaggression was in there. There were a couple of citations from the early mid-1970s. And then I took those, looked at them, read a few old, more recent citations that have been added to the paper files. And then I started doing the database work, searching for good examples of use to sort of create a timeline, a sort of biography of the word. How did it evolve? When did it, what were the early usages? They turned out to be mostly academic. When did it start to emerge? Again, in academia, when did it cross over into popular consciousness? A little bit more recently, the 2000s. How rapid was the growth? You can do that by charting how much a word is used and in what contexts over the course of a year. And I did all of that, sort of watching charting the progress of microaggression in the language and how it was used. When did it switch from being a hyphenated term, which it was initially, to being a single word? So you're trying to like do this like forensic sleuthing about the history of a term so that you can then sit down and craft a short, concise explanation of what something means. And that's what I did. It took me.
Well, and you say this, though, this is but you say clear and concise, but also comprehensible as to feel obvious.
Yes.
That seemed like an important point, right?
That's the most important part of it. And fortunately, I had an editor at Merriam-Webster, a guy named Steve Perot, whose title was the Director of Defining, which I love.
Greatest title ever.
Wonderful, wonderful title, greatest title ever. And Steve would work with me like I was a newbie definer, because I was.
Yeah.
And he would respond to drafts, make suggestions, point out where I was wrong and what I was misunderstanding, either grammatically or just structurally in the definition. So with Steve's help, I would write drafts just like I would do in journalism. And it took me, like I was about to say, like probably 10 times as long to do a single definition as it would an experienced definer. I got lost in rabbit holes. I would just go down into the databases and just looked at hundreds of examples of usage to try to pull out the perfect sentence that illuminated the meaning that you could attach to the definition. And also reading all of the sentences that use the word to try to distill what are the narrow differences? What was the writer trying to get at in their use of microaggression in a particular context? It's much more nuanced than people might think.
Stefan Fatsis. We're talking about his new book. It's called Unabridged, The Thrill of and Threat to the Modern Dictionary. take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, helping to make Easter dinner easy with ready-to-heat and serve citrus-glazed ham, au gratin potatoes, deviled eggs, and pastry trays. Make it easy with Harmon's.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist and writer and word enthusiast, Stefan Fatsis. Fatsis is a word freak, which is actually the name of a book he wrote about Scrabble a few years ago. His latest is also about an obsession of his, dictionaries. The book is called Unabridged, and in it, he embeds at Merriam-Webster Dictionary in Springfield, Massachusetts, to research and debate words and their definitions. And along the way, he digs into the history of Merriam-Webster and the roots of the American dictionary. Let's get back to our conversation. You write in the book about how, as you were embedded there with Merriam, that you felt like a participant in what you describe as this human endeavor that stretched back for, you know, thousands of years. And then it gave you a kind of reverence for a deeper history. You don't spend a lot of time on the deeper history, but can you say a little bit about what was going on hundreds, thousands of years, these sort of word-collecting projects? They weren't really producing dictionaries necessarily, but what was happening? How did it work back then?
Yeah, I think it's a human instinct to try to make sense of the ways that we communicate with each other. So you can go back to the third millennium BCE in ancient Sumeria, and there were lists of words, cuneiform lists, that were recorded on clay tablets. And every successive civilization conjured ways to collect and decode the way that they communicated, the way people communicated with one another. Greeks and Romans, German scholars, the English philologists in the 19th century. The idea was always there. The methodology evolved. Initially, these collections of words were mostly used for scholars, but the idea of what we think of as a modern dictionary, this list in alphabetical order with a headword at the top of the page so you can locate what you're looking for easily, that's a fairly modern concept. The first, what's considered to be the first monolingual English dictionary, was published in 1604, and that was the start of it. So 1600, 400 years ago or so, not very long. But this book had lists in alphabetical order, definitions, etymologies, the things that would become the basic elements of modern dictionaries.
You mentioned, you talked about Samuel Johnson a moment ago. I liked the way he thought of words as, in the way it seems like that you do, or that dictionaries now do, as more kind of fluid. He didn't want the language, this is how you put it, it was a snapshot of language at a moment in time. So that's how he thought of it, I guess.
And he really was the first person to sort of articulate that, to recognize that language isn't sacrosanct, that it shifts and changes every day with usage. We're not, we don't stop creating words, modifying the way they're used, coming up with new interpretations for them, and new contexts to use them in. Johnson got that. And so did Noah Webster. Webster produced his first dictionary in 1806, and it was widely panned. Webster had a very, very dogmatic view and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. Webster believed strongly that this new country needed its own dictionary in order to set itself apart from the British, that we have our own language with our own terms, our own creations, and we need a place to gather all of that. He had these some wacky ideas.
Well, I want to talk about language. Let's spend some time with him because I want to talk about some of the wacky ideas. But maybe start by just explaining who he is. You describe him arrogant, argumentative, snobby, and complicated. Just tell us who Noah Webster was, and we can talk about some of his ideas.
Noah Webster was one of the most important figures in early American history.
Yeah.
He is sort of an unacknowledged founding father. He was a little young for the Revolution, but he was a lawyer and a newspaper publisher and a political hanger-on, an editorial writer, very opinionated, very controversial in his time. He engendered strong opinions from opponents, especially when he was publishing a newspaper in New York. And he also was an educator. He wrote this series of workbooks for children called the Blue-Backed Speller that sold millions of copies over their lifetime. And it was out of those successful publications that people started asking Noah Webster to write a dictionary. And I think the idea of creating a dictionary solidified in Webster this belief that we need a dictionary to establish further an American identity, that without this book or a book like this, we are not our own country yet. We need to change language so that it's different from what the English have exported. And we need to acknowledge and find a way to collect all of the important and interesting terminology that's been created since Europeans landed on the continent.
So he's an important figure with this grand idea about language, but he's a crappy businessman. And that gets us to George and Charles Merriam, who then end up sort of buying the rights to Webster's dictionary. Talk about in what condition the dictionary was when they get it and buy it, and how they transform it into, I think you sort of say they basically turn it into a consumer product in some way.
George and Charles Merriam were printers and publishers, and they moved their headquarters to Springfield, Massachusetts in the early 1840s. Webster dies in 1843. Webster did supervise a second edition of his book in 1841. And one of the brothers was at a trade show in New York, a publishing trade show. And George hears that the person that had acquired Webster's dictionary right after Webster's death was interested in selling the rights to it. And George immediately writes to his brother Charles from his hotel room in New York and says that this guy, Adams, is coming home to Amherst. I'm going to persuade him to stop in Springfield, and you should interview him and arrange for the acquisition of the dictionary. And what he writes is that half that book, and I'm quoting, would probably be worth permanently more than anything we have or ever shall have else. So the Merriam brothers recognize that there is a market for this. Webster was charging the equivalent of $600 in contemporary dollars. For more than $660 for his American dictionary.
Wow.
Charged $20 for it. The Merriam brothers realized that's way too much.
Yeah.
We want this to be available to the public. They cut the price in half. They cut it even further going forward. These were businessmen through and through who transformed dictionary making in America from this solo enterprise, Noah Webster toiling in his donut-shaped desk, to an actual business with lots of people working on creating this reference source.
So they added research and an editing process and
a staff.
A staff, yeah. So that's the transition period that it goes through. It becomes a sort of a product that's rational and evidence-based. And then it goes through that transformation that you were referring to earlier in 1961. Say a little bit more about how a dictionary had been thought of as prescriptive. But then – and you have to talk about this remarkable person named Philip Gove. It becomes something else. It becomes descriptive. Talk about this transition in dictionaries.
The evolution after the Merriam brothers in the decades following were such that initially it was revising Noah's work.
Yeah.
But with a sort of very professional approach, much more scientific approach, domain experts in charge of writing definitions about subject matters they knew. And again, marketing the book in a way that was affordable to the public, creating an abridgment of this big, fat, unabridged dictionary that was slimmed down and you could keep on a desk and would be smaller. This was called the Collegiate Dictionary with this aspirational title, college.
Yeah.
And in the early part of the 20th century, the book just blows up. And I mean physically. The editors at Merriam come to view the dictionary as this magisterial document created by learned men. And in order to appeal to as wide a range of the public as possible, the book should not just be a list of words with definitions, it should be encyclopedic. There should be lists of things that people might be curious about. Popes and place names and fictional characters, you name it. The dictionary that Merriam publishes in 1934, that book is as big as a book could possibly be. Literally, a bookbinder could not make a bigger single volume. And the editors of that book and the previous editions had come to be sort of these titular figures who had important titles in academia or government. And what Philip Gove does when he is named the editor of the Webster's Third, which will be published in 1961, is that he attempts to democratize the dictionary. His bosses at Merriam first brought in a Brown professor who could be the titular head of the book as editor. And that guy walks away and says, "You don't need me. You've got all the experts that are necessary here in this building. They know more about lexicography than I do." And he walks away from the project, and the Merriam board promotes Philip Gove, this editor, to run the dictionary. And Gove is probably the most influential figure in modern lexicography.
Yeah.
The way a dictionary looks today is because of Philip Gove. I mean, the books from the 19th century are recognizable, of course, but Gove makes a bunch of very important changes. One is that he decrees that the book needs to be modern. It needs to reflect culture as it is now.
Yeah.
So fewer quotes from the Bible and dead white men, and more quotes about words from figures in popular culture. He changes the way definitions are written so that you can take the definition and plunk it in place of the word that it's defining in a sentence, and it would still make sense. He cuts back on a lot of verbiage. He tries to make definitions easier to read. He claims that by eliminating commas, he saved 80 pages in the dictionary. And he gets rid of all of that extraneous encyclopedic material so that the book could focus on words. And those are all kind of modern revolutionary changes that shape the way we think about what a dictionary definition is and what it should contain.
Stefan Fatsis. His book is Unabridged, The Thrill of and Threat to the Modern Dictionary. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist and writer Stefan Fatsis. We're talking about his new book, which is a look inside the world of dictionaries, how they function, who decides which words make the cut, and, of course, the debates over meaning that can stretch on for years. Really, it's a book about language itself. It's called Unabridged. You write in the book about how the dictionary dealt with slurs and controversial words. There's this story you tell. In 1997, there's this African-American magazine, a public affairs magazine. They published this story about these two women who were offended because the Merriam definition of the N-word had it as a black person. And you say the company got tons of these really angry letters. And one of the parts of the book is you say you sat down and you read them all. Tell us about that, if you would.
I mean, it was jarring and overwhelming to see all of this laid out, to imagine the feelings of the people who were motivated to write to a dictionary company and tell them how they actually felt about this word. Merriam's response initially was sort of academic, clinical, and defensive. That this is a word. Our job is to reflect all the words that are used. We don't like the fact that this is a word, but it's important that it stays in the dictionary. Merriam did begin this process, and this is the late 90s, it's pretty recent, of revising the way it handles slurs because of the complaints, which made a very good point that words like the N-word and other slurs, their meaning is really as a slur. And that's the only salient point about the word. You can have a monitory label explaining how bad this word is. You can have a usage note that explains that this is the worst slur in the English language. But ultimately, when people see that definition that you articulated, they make a connection. And the reality is that's not what these words mean. These words are just tools. They are used to offend. They are used to demean. They are used to hurt. And over time, Merriam, and I'm talking about over 25 years, Merriam came to adjust the way that it defines words. And I think you can trace those changes back to the activism of the people who started this write-in campaign back in the late 1990s.
Where do dictionaries fit in this particular, I guess, political moment where institutions are not being trusted in the same way they used to? You mentioned one retired editor who said that legacy dictionaries faced the same distrust of traditional authorities that media and government did. But what does that mean? How can you not trust a dictionary?
Because you don't understand the mechanics of it and because you don't use it as much. Dictionaries don't have the same cultural cachet that they did. You know, I'm in my early 60s. I got that dictionary in the mid-1970s, the one that my mom gave me on my 11th birthday. The dictionary mattered because you believed what was in it. Today, kids don't really use dictionaries. And when they do, they are not able to distinguish between crowdsourced works or legacy dictionaries like Merriam-Webster or something generated by AI. There's a diffusion of knowledge on the internet so that you can't be sure what you're getting when you type a word into a search bar.
Yeah.
Maybe it's good. Maybe it's not. Maybe AI has distorted the meaning of a particular word, or maybe it's copied verbatim from data scraped from Merriam-Webster or another dictionary publisher. Merriam has tried to sort of push back against this loss of authority. Just this week, Merriam published a new print edition of its collegiate dictionary, the first new edition in more than 20 years. And you might say, why? The tonnage for Merriam's business, the revenue, is from the website. Yeah. Is that they, you know, they get hundreds of millions of clicks a month, right? It's successful. They have games. They have other ways to get you to stick there so that there are users that can justify ad rates to generate revenue. And yet Merriam comes out with this 5-pound book.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
One reason is that there's an appeal for people who love words and have a nostalgia factor. It's kind of like vinyl records.
Yeah.
I'm going to buy a physical dictionary and it's new. But the second and I think more relevant marketing angle that Merriam has taken is that the dictionary is real intelligence. It's not artificial intelligence. Mm. It doesn't take long to look up a word. It's sitting right there. It'll serve the same purposes as you going onto Google and typing something into the search engine. There's a reliability there. So Merriam is trying to sort of reclaim the authority ground at a time when all of these other institutions are declining. Merriam is saying, hey, we're still there, and it's really simple to understand why we are trusted and why our work should be believed. And I think their marketing has been really clever on this, and I think effective.
Can a chatbot do what a lexicographer does? That is, can it compose a definition? Can it understand where a word fits in the culture?
Yes.
Which raises, Stefan, a bigger question that you ask, and that is the role of lexicographer going to exist in the future? Or is it slowly dying, or is it evolving? These are some of the things you sort of work through.
It's certainly, as a business, if not dying, in decline.
Yeah.
20 years ago, there were probably 200 or so working full-time commercial lexicographers in North America. The names of dictionaries that, if you're of a certain age, say over 40, may remember, like Webster's New World or Random House or the American Heritage Dictionary, those companies are out of business. They're not updating their books if they're publishing them at all. There's probably around 30 or 40, maybe, full-time lexicographers, most of them at Merriam-Webster, some at dictionary.com, but that's it. Can ChatGPT perform those jobs well? Yeah. I mean, I have a chapter about artificial intelligence in the book, and ChatGPT does a pretty good job of crafting a definition. There are academics who are studying this and prompting ChatGPT or other bots to create entire dictionaries. It's doable. Does that mean it's better? I mean, no. If you understand that large language models are just aggregated text that picks what the most likely next word in a sequence is going to be, you can't be sure that the nuance is reflected in that work. I think there's a role for human beings to do this. Lexicographers don't cost that much in, you know, compared to other things in our society. To me, there should be a place for humans to continue to do this work. The question going forward is going to be, who's going to fund that work? You know, Merriam is surviving well right now. It's doing pretty well. It's a subsidiary of Britannica Company. Like I said, it's adapted nicely by diversifying its offerings on its website and getting into other businesses. Is that model guaranteed going forward? Do we need some sort of, as in journalism, sort of nonprofit model that might work better? Is there a hybrid model? Is there a billionaire who really, really cares and won't walk away after a few years from the dictionary business that might be willing to fund it? Should academia be involved the way it is at Oxford? These are unanswered questions right now. So the business itself kind of limps along. I don't think you're going to be seeing any dictionary startups in the United States in the next few years, but you never know with technology and the quirky interests of an individual.
This gets us finally to something you say at the end of the book about something you were talking about early on. It's something that you describe as the kind of the soul of the dictionary. It's this idea that language is slippery and that it's, you know, always shifting. And as you put it, it's always collapsing on itself. So a dictionary doesn't capture permanence. And it seems like you wonder if even AI can capture that slippery nature. It's like there's nothing that can fully contain and collect every word. And what you say at the end is you hope that humans will be up for the task. Say something about that, finally, if you would.
So many words, so few people that are engaged in this profession, so little time. The speed with which language changes, particularly in the internet age and through social media, is, as every dictionary editor for the last 200 years has maintained, greater than ever before. And there's probably some truth to that today. You take a word like COVID, which through these horrific, extraordinary circumstances went from non-existent one day to known by virtually the entire planet within a few days. That's amazing. And it has to do with the modern technologies for sharing and distributing language and communication. Computers are really good at aggregating language and helping lexicographers in particular identify new terms and where they are used and where and how they first emerged. But in the end, there is so much knowledge and so much created that you still need a way to distill that into a package that is consumable and comprehensible. And you need people to do that. Even if you asked a ChatGPT or some other bot to write a dictionary, it might not get it right. It's a complicated process of determining what rises to a particular threshold, what deserves to be acknowledged. It's always a moving target, language, and people right now are better than anyone else, I think, at when you get to that collection step, taking it further and crafting these little nuggets that people want to read. So there's a lot of opportunity in lexicography right now because the dictionary and other the internet and other technologies offer tremendous potential for integrating words and pictures and sound in creating these little biographies of words. And that's the exciting part. The money is probably the greatest unknown. Is there enough to be really creative and sort of reshape and redefine the way dictionaries function? Do people want something different? All of that is going to take enormous investment. And I just hope that there are companies or humans out there that view this as essential to culture and democracy and knowledge.
Stefan Fatsis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug. It's been a pleasure.
Stefan Fatsis. His new book is Unabridged, The Thrill of and Threat to the Modern Dictionary. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can email us at radiowest.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.